Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Pinterest, though not as popular as Facebook or Twitter yet, has quickly become one of the top social media sites. It is an online pin board for posting and sharing images and is popular with all kinds of people, especially those interested in fashion, design, the visual arts, technology. Just like on Facebook and Twitter, you can follow other people's accounts on Pinterest, and some have amassed quite large followings. Joining us now to discuss Pinterest is Robert Anthony. He is a tech journalist, and he has gathered more than 1.3 million followers on Pinterest. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So just in general, is 1.3 million sounds like a lot to me. Is it a lot?
It is a lot. I don't know how I got so many so quickly, but according to some of the websites I've looked at, I'm among the top 100 in the world in terms of followers.
What made you try it in the first place?
As I told a friend of mine, I'll try anything once when it comes to tech.
Okay.
But basically, it was an experiment just to see what it looked like, see how easy it was to post a photo and a caption. And then I was just going to blog about it and leave it alone, just sort of another article about another new piece of tech. And that was really going to be it.
My guest is Robert Anthony, freelance tech journalist and one of the top 100,
I guess you call it Pinterest pinners.
Okay, one of the top 100. Thank you. I didn't know what the lingo was. Top 100 Pinterest pinters in the world. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you have a question or comment for Robert Anthony, you can also post it on Facebook. I am not checking Pinterest yet, so don't bother with that. So you weren't an early adopter of Pinterest. This wasn't 1.3 million people that happened over the period of several months or something.
I mean, I was on it for a few months, and I might have had, say, 80 followers at one point. Mm-hmm. And something happened in August. I think that somebody with a million followers already repinned one of my posts. And what that means is that they take a picture from your page and repost it on their page. So somehow I got a lot of people looking at my my board, is what they're called on Pinterest, a lot of people at once, because I woke up one Monday morning and it said, you have 987 new followers. The next day it was 2,000. The next day it was something like that. And within, say, 2 months, I was at 500,000. The traction just kept up, and I'm not sure what caused it, but I'm thinking that Pinterest users are a little bit geeky, and I'm a gadget pinner. So I believe that that has something to do with it.
So there is the geometric progression part of it, where sometimes people just start following someone their friends are following.
Exactly.
And then there's the actual content, and in this case, the content. You don't just post somebody else's stuff, though. You create posts. They're original.
That's a good point. I mean, I'm a freelance technology journalist. I used to be the senior writer at PC Magazine, where I reviewed laptops and desktop computers back then. Nowadays, I go to press conferences for new phones, like the new Samsung Galaxy S4. I'll go to that conference, take a photo of the new phone, post it on Pinterest, and write a little short caption. So it's actually, my board tends to be a little bit newsy. So it's my photos and my short caption, which I think helps because it makes my board a little bit unique. I think that's what other people can do to increase their followers. Make your board unique. Throw in a photo that other people don't have and use your own knowledge to enhance the photo with a couple sentences to explain why that photo is interesting.
If you have a question for Robert Anthony, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about Pinterest. Are you a Pinterest fan or fanatic? Give us a call and tell us why. I would love to hear about some other great ideas for posting on Pinterest to get more followers. Now, is a goal of somebody on Pinterest to get followers necessarily? For me, I'll say for me, Pinterest was literally a way to organize stuff I see on the internet so I don't forget it, you know, cool stuff that I see, and I don't want to forget about it.
That's absolutely a great way to use Pinterest, and some journalists do just that. They do little collections so that they can remember, say, images from a press event they were at or from a city that they visited or just from a general coverage of an event. And right, it won't be necessarily for the sake of followers, but it'll be for the sake of being organized. And the nice thing about Pinterest is that it's, well, A, it's free, and B, it's easy to get started. So even a dummy like me can get up to speed fairly quickly. But you know, followers is sort of a strange thing, and I quite frankly think that I benefited, as I said in Columbus to journalists last week, that I benefited from a huge sack of dumb luck falling on my head.
What kind of accounts, what kind of Pinterest accounts do you follow?
I follow fellow journalists, not actually, when I look at them, they're not all tech-related. Some of them are photo-related. I used to be a photographer. Some of them are just general office technology without being too techie, like a nice pencil holder. I don't know. It makes something that makes your office look nice. I do follow the other tech journalists, but, you know, I do that elsewhere. I do that on Twitter. I do that on Facebook. Pinterest is my sort of pinning page, not my following page.
And besides the post, what you know, which was a great, you know, if you're going to take a pic, take your own picture of something. But you also mentioned, say something about it that you think is why it makes it interesting. And I like to do that, too. When I post something, I like to tell people why. Is it that special color blue? Is it that cool map of Michigan? Whatever it might be. It's more authentic that way.
Right. Everybody's good at something. Everybody has a skill. And if you're really good at something, let it show in the page. Instead of just taking a photo of a cute cat, if you know the breed and you know the history of that type of cat, go ahead, write two sentences to explain why this cute-looking cat is relevant. I posted a photo from the toy fair, and it's what it looks like is a potty for a child with an iPad stand connected to it, and that's exactly what it is. It's a potty training device that uses an iPad. And my caption was, "Would you do this to your iPad?" But you know, and I got a whole bunch of repens just because of that, you know, cute little comment at the beginning. Everybody could do that. Just a little. It doesn't even have to be technically. You know, it doesn't have to be a technical comment. It can just be nice and funny or quirky or what have you.
You know, I heard about that thing, that gadget. Now I wish I would have been following you at the time so I could actually see what they were talking about. Some people use Pinterest to promote themselves as a brand. You know, they're doing it for business. What's a good way to do that so it's not a turnoff? Because I stop following people on Twitter and Facebook and stuff when they're constantly pummeling me with, you know, come to this, come to that. This is my latest product. I can't stand that.
I agree with that. I have very good friends who tweet a lot and pin a lot, and I just can't follow them because it just clutters up my screen too much, and I have other things to do. I agree with that. Your feelings with that concerned. Most of the people on Pinterest who have a million followers or so, they have like 500 pins or 1,000 pins, or I think the world leader with 11 million followers, I think she has closing in on 10,000 pins. I have like 100. So I don't pin that often, which I think leads to a little anticipation. What's he going to pin next? You know, did he pin today?
Uh-huh.
I think that little bit helps because my board is a little bit newsy, and I think a lot of other people do it better than I do, quite frankly. I think there are a lot of smarter people on Pinterest than I. I just think somehow I got traction through luck and timing.
Who's your favorite Pinterest pinter? Pinner?
The person. Wow, I already forgot her name. I like the travel sites. I'll pull up Pinterest while I'm speaking.
Okay.
I think her. But as you can see, I do more pinning than reading, quite frankly, there. but my favorite sites are travel because I'm also a travel writer. That's part of the reason I was in Columbus last week. I like my fellow tech reporters, Walt Mossberg at the Wall Street Journal, David Pogue at the New York Times, people like that. Uh-huh. They actually don't have that many followers because they do better elsewhere on Facebook, on Twitter. They really don't need Pinterest as part of their program.
But it makes a lot of sense for travel.
It certainly does. If you can take a good photo and write a nice couple nice sentences, and if they're your photos, you can actually get a little bit of traction. My one photo from the auto show of the inside of a concept car, now not everybody gets to open the concept car and enter them with a camera. But journalists are allowed to, so I took advantage of my opportunity. So that's a unique photo that you won't see readily elsewhere. There are other people with a similar photo, but making it unique and using your opportunities helps.
You have one of your other suggestions is think vertical. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I hadn't thought about that before, but it makes a lot of sense. Tell us why.
Pinterest is just designed that way. They design their site as if they were newspaper columns. They go top to bottom, and longer photos simply show up better. So actually, it's a good idea if you have a horizontal photo to combine it with another one with your Photoshop or whatever into one longer vertical photo. It'll look better, and you might get better traction that way. More people will look at it, and it's easier to it looks better on someone else's site when they repin it.
Robert Anthony, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. Hopefully I'll get another chance to visit Columbus real soon.
I hope so. Robert Anthony, he's a freelance tech journalist. He's also one of the top 100 pinners on Pinterest in the world. So go to Pinterest and start following him if you want to know why. Meanwhile, coming up, we're going to be talking to a digital marketer and the co-author of a guidebook called Your Digital Afterlife, which will help you decide what to do with all of your Pinterest pins when you go away. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thanks for joining us today on 89.7 NPR News. 69 degrees in downtown Columbus. There's about a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms today and a high in the lower 70s. Rain is likely for tonight, maybe a thunderstorm, and a low of 53. About a 40% chance of rain on Wednesday. Support for 89.7 comes from EarthShare Ohio, going green to support the conservation and environmental issues that affect us all. Environment Volunteer Opportunities for this Earth Day, April 22nd, is online at EarthShareOhio.org. And support comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with the philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We all know that it's important to write a will and get our affairs in order. So in case of unforeseen, or while we know it's all happening eventually, our families can make sense of our property when we're gone. Still, so many of us put it off. In the 21st century, it is not only our physical property that we have to consider, but our digital accounts as well. Last week, Google rolled out the Inactive Account Manager. It is a way to assign who gets to control your data after you're gone. Joining us now to discuss this and other tips to take care of that data after we're gone is Evan Carroll. He's one of the founders of the site, The Digital Beyond, and co-author of a guidebook called Your Digital Afterlife. He joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome to the show, Evan.
Thank you for having me today.
Can you explain how this new Google Account Manager works?
So in short, in your Google Account Settings page, you now have the ability to specify what should happen to specific data in your Google account once you're gone. And how you do that, you go into your account settings, you go to the Inactive Account Manager, and the first thing you set up is a waiting period. And this can be anywhere from 3 months to 12 months. And it's where you specify, after this amount of time has passed since my last login, take the following action. And 1 month before that would expire, you would receive notification that says, hey there, we're about to go ahead and do what you said for us to do if we hadn't heard from you. This is your last chance to say you're still here. And then you can choose what you want to happen to your account. You can choose that it be deleted. You can specify up to 10 contacts to receive either notification or actually receive access to certain pieces of data, and you can specify which data they can access. You can also set up an autoresponder message. So if folks send you a Gmail message, it would respond and say that you're no longer using that account. And this is the first time we've seen a service provider say to their users proactively ahead of time, what do you want to happen to your account when you no longer use it?
I guess all this stuff is starting to be around long enough where we've amassed and some people are starting to die and it's just going to come up a few times. This is just for Google, though. So you're saying this is the first time. So Facebook doesn't have anything like this. Pinterest doesn't have anything like this.
Right. So Facebook has a slightly different policy. Facebook allows for a profile to be memorialized, and you can request that a profile be memorialized. The request can come from anyone, so long as you have an obituary or death certificate or some other way to prove to Facebook that that person's account is that person is no longer with us. Mm-hmm. And what happens to a memorialized Facebook account? The login credentials, the username and password, those no longer work. And you no longer show up in certain places on the Facebook site, for instance, where you might be reminded to connect with users you haven't talked to in a while. They no longer show deceased users in that list to prevent an unwelcome reminder. But the account and the profile remain active so that friends can post memories on that page. Pinterest, and I know that was the subject of our earlier discussion, mm-hmm. They actually don't have a specific policy. And they allow you to close your account at any time. However, they do not have a policy on what happens when you pass away.
My guest is Evan Carroll, digital marketer and co-author of a guidebook called Your Digital Afterlife. Google has a new inactive account manager. It's new. It's a new way to assign who gets to control your data after you're gone. If you have a question about the general topic, not just Google, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Will the fact, if you're always updating your passwords, will this have any effect on on any of this?
Well, sure. So some individuals recommend, and it's also recommended in my book, that you keep a list of your usernames and passwords, and you place them in a secure location that is accessible to your heirs when you pass, and make sure you make your wishes known. Now, keeping that secure is indeed a challenge and something that we should all strive to do. But The neat thing about Google's new Inactive Account Manager is even if you have changed your password, it doesn't matter. But because Google is controlling what happens as opposed to you having to have a third party like an executor take care of these things for you. Now, there are certain advantages to having an executor get your information. So it is important that for services that don't have this type of service and you would like certain things to happen to that, you would want to make sure that someone in your family knows how to access that and knows how what you would like to happen to it. And there are numerous ways you can secure this information. I won't go into all of them, but it's important to be thinking about this kind of planning ahead of time.
Can you divvy up what people see, what you want people to see? Maybe you want someone to see photos, but not your Google Docs.
Mm-hmm. In the Inactive Account Manager, you can specify what types of data can go to certain people. So you can actually specify that your photograph should be accessible to someone, but your email should not be accessible to them. So you do have that level of granular control with their tool.
My guest once again is Evan Carroll, digital marketer and the co-author of a guidebook called Your Digital Afterlife. That's what we're talking about right now, your digital afterlife. You don't want to think about it, I know, but you might have questions for Evan. We may be breaking soon. President Obama is expected to make a statement any minute regarding the tragedy at the Boston Marathon yesterday. So bear with us if and when that occurs. Once again, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. And so, Evan, you do see a trend of other tech companies following this?
Absolutely. Google's decision to do this tells me that they have decided to place time and effort into building this tool. And that's an indication to me that that their old policy, and I'm not sure if they're going to retire this policy or not, that would give access to your legal executor and they had to provide a whole stack of legal documentation to gain access to your account, it tells me that that process was perhaps becoming too time-intensive for their employees, that they were spending too much time dealing with these requests one by one. So this is an effort to make it so that they don't have to deal with those. So that tells me that it made good business sense for them to build this tool. And I can only imagine that as the internet generation grows older, as we're seeing more and more people who have lived online pass away, that the many services, Facebook, Twitter, I imagine that many of them will follow this example that Google has set out.
One more thing. When somebody is notified, what happens when they're notified that they have access to this information?
So when they're notified with Google's tool, they receive an email message that tells them that they have been left this information by the Inactive Account Manager. There's actually a message in that the person who set it up gets to write. So I set up mine the other day, and I had to write a very strange message to my relatives saying, hey, here's my data. I hope you never read this message, but here it is. And then they have a period of 3 months that they can download that information once they're notified.
Should you tell people that you've named them in your will?
I think it's important that you tell them because you want them, you certainly don't want them to be surprised by something they learn. I think it's useful if they can sort of prepare themselves ahead of time that they know they're going to be receiving this type of information. It's important to have these conversations, even though we don't like to think about death, it's important to make sure we're talking to our family members and making them aware of what our wishes are, because something that would be very stressful for them would be to have to make decisions and have no idea what your wishes would have been. It's much easier for them to know what you would have wanted to happen so that they can help carry that out without doubt in their mind.
It's kind of interesting because we think we don't have a lot to leave behind in terms of our writings, in terms of our correspondence and stuff, because it's all online. But that's really not true when you think about it, right? Oh,
absolutely.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to interrupt our show now. The president is, President Obama is speaking now about the Boston Marathon bombings.
Lisa Monaco on the attacks in Boston. We continue to mobilize and deploy all appropriate law enforcement resources to protect our citizens and investigate and to respond to this attack. Obviously, our first thoughts this morning are with the victims, their families, and the city of Boston. We know that two explosions gravely wounded dozens of Americans and took the lives of others, including a 8-year-old boy. This was a heinous and cowardly act, and given what we now know about what took place, the FBI is investigating it as an act of terrorism. Anytime bombs are used to target innocent civilians, it is an act of terror. What we don't yet know, however, is who carried out this attack or why, whether it was planned and executed by a terrorist organization, foreign or domestic, or was the act of a malevolent individual. That's what we don't yet know, and clearly we're at the beginning of our investigation. It will take time to follow every lead and determine what happened, but we will find out. We will find whoever harmed our citizens, and we will bring them to justice. We also know this. The American people refuse to be terrorized, because what the world saw yesterday in the aftermath of the explosions were stories of heroism and kindness and generosity and love. Exhausted runners who kept running to the nearest hospital to give blood, and those who stayed to tend to the wounded, some tearing off their own clothes to make tourniquets. The first responders who ran into the chaos to save lives. The men and women who are still treating the wounded at some of the best hospitals in the world. And the medical students who hurried to help, saying, "When we heard, we all came in." The priests who opened their churches and ministered to the hurt and the fearful. And the good people of Boston who opened their homes to the victims of this attack and those shaken by it. So if you want to know who we are, what America is, how we respond to evil, that's it. Selflessly, compassionately, unafraid.
President Obama at the White House.
In the coming days, we will pursue every effort to get to the bottom of what happened, and we will continue to remain vigilant. I've directed my administration to take appropriate security measures to protect the American people, and this is a good time for all of us to remember that we all have a part to play in alerting authorities if you see something suspicious. Speak up. I have extraordinary confidence in the men and women of the FBI, the Boston Police Department, and the other agencies that responded so heroically and effectively in the aftermath of yesterday's events. I'm very grateful for the leadership of Governor Patrick and Mayor Menino, and I know that even as we protect our people and aggressively pursue this investigation, the people of Boston will continue to respond in the same proud and heroic way that they have thus far. And their fellow Americans will be right there with them. Thank you very much. And you can expect further briefings from our law enforcement officials as the day goes on. When we have more details, they will be disclosed. What I've indicated to you is what we know now. We know it was bombs that were set off. We know that, obviously, they did some severe damage. We do not know who did them. We do not know whether this is an act of an organization or an individual or individuals. We don't have a sense of motive yet. So everything else at this point is speculation. But as we receive more information, as the FBI has more information, as our counterterrorism teams have more information, we will make sure to keep you and the American people posted. All right? Thank you very much, everybody.
That was President Barack Obama speaking about the bombings in Boston at the Boston Marathon yesterday. We're still with Evan Carroll, digital marketer and co-author of a guidebook called Your Digital Afterlife. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for staying with us, Evan. Can we go back to the last question I asked, which is how much stuff we have out there?
Sure. We absolutely have... More stuff than we realize digitally. If we you think about the obvious things, our emails and then the various photographs and messages that we have stored at sites like Facebook and Twitter. But there are also some things that are ours digitally that we don't think about as a part of our state. For instance, we have, let's say you run a home business. Maybe you sell things on eBay and you receive revenue through your PayPal account. Or let's say you sell on Etsy and that's connected to your email account. We have all of these financial accounts that we manage via digital accounts that are tied to our email accounts. And the thing to remember is that as that these accounts aren't exactly known to our heirs, nothing comes in the mail for these accounts in postal mail. So it's important that we make sure they're aware of them, else they just simply might not know that they exist and might not even think to look into accessing them.
Well, Evan Kirill, thanks for joining us today again. I appreciate your time and hopefully look forward to another conversation, man.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Evan Kirill, digital marketer and the co-author of the guidebook, Your Digital Afterlife. Coming up, Russell Holley, a tech blogger for Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The next fresh air, the new Christian evangelical adoption movement that promotes adoption as a way of fulfilling a biblical mandate. It's sending tens of thousands of evangelicals overseas to adopt, but the children aren't always really orphans. We'll talk with Catherine Joyce about her new book, The Child Catchers, Rescue, Trafficking, and the New Gospel. Join us.
Fresh air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow for a discussion of the rite of passage that affects many young people, finding themselves and where they fit into society. And then it's Exercise Myths on Wellness Wednesday. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 until noon here on 89.7 NPR News. 69 degrees. There's about a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms today, a high right around 71. Rain is more likely for tonight, as well as thunderstorms, and a low of 53. Support comes from the Bethel Dental Care, providing general dentistry from pediatrics to geriatrics in a comfortable atmosphere. A proud supporter and promoter of WOSU programming. More information at 614-451-0341 or online at BethelDentalCare.com. And support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. There has been a lot of news and controversy about unmanned drones in the sky above our heads. Now it's possible that the water soon won't be safe from unmanned robotic vehicles either. Here to tell us about that and other gadget news is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome, Russell.
Hi, you made that sound so terrible.
I know, I didn't even write it. Blame my producer, Michael DeBonis, for that one. I guess I was like, wait a minute. this is kind of dark now. Everybody out there, it is Russell Holley. So if you have a question about anything, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, all right, let's chill this out a second. It's called Liquid Robotics SV3. Tell me everything you know.
So these guys have made a couple of these before. They are, they're drones in the sense that they are autonomous and they are robotic and they kind of float out in the water and do this thing. But they're actually designed more for just kind of gathering data about the kind of the environment around them, which would be, pretty much the middle of the ocean. What makes these things kind of unique is that they're shaped like surfboard with a whole separate compartment that floats down in the ocean that has a really special design that captures the motion of waves as they are on the top of the ocean to power tiny motors in the bottom that actually power the batteries that keep all of the equipment alive.
You know, in his defense, I think Michael DeBonis, the producer who wrote that, has a point. He said, you made it sound like Terminator 2 on your post. You said
I referenced Waterworld in the post that I wrote. So I get the kind of post-apocalyptic thing there. But
yeah.
the goal there was that they don't require ever having a person interact with them, especially this new model. They have solar panels on top, and they have the little paddle motors underneath, and they're really designed to be just about as autonomous as you can get with something that you're sticking out in the ocean to collect data. And now this particular model, this is the newest model, it actually has the ability to process that information and give you results based on specific queries. To use for really kind of any kind of ocean analysis. It's really interesting stuff.
Has the Pentagon called them yet?
The Pentagon has not called them yet, as far as I know. And I don't think that they're weaponized or anything like that. I'm pretty sure that they just float around and talk about the weather all day.
What does it look like? You said they're small.
Well, so they're roughly surfboard sized, but it's a surfboard with this this cable that comes out of the bottom to an entire another smaller device down at the bottom. And that smaller device is what does all of the kind of the number crunching and data storage and things like that. So all of the things that are down below is where all the computer equipment is and where the paddles that receive the wave information to charge it. But then it has this whole floating unit on top that has solar panels, and its job is to basically yank the bottom part along to give it power.
And who's paying attention to these things?
Well, so they're actually designed to be as easy to ignore as possible. But really, what they're built so that if another craft is in the area, because they don't really drive, they don't have motors attached to them to steer out of the way or anything. So they're really built to just float, essentially. So the people that are paying attention to them are people who are interested in, deep ocean, or not even necessarily deep ocean, but, out in the middle of the ocean, analytics for any kind of activity.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page, post your question or comment there for Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com. You can ask him about anything tech-related, and we'll see if we can stump him. All right, so how much do these things cost? Can I run out and buy one?
They haven't put a price tag on any of them. And these are really more, scientific vessels. Built for just kind of capturing information. But what was really cool about the design that they have here now, and now that it has the ability to process the information that it collects and receive instructions remotely and all of that stuff, is that it is feasible, within the next year or so, for one of these to be used for even kind of a commercial thing, because it's energy-wise self-sustaining. So in theory, you could have like a website, for example, that is entirely powered by the ocean.
Wow. Interesting.
So, I mean, you would basically need to have one of these with a constant, satellite-driven, internet connection, which these have, and GPS. But the processing power on board is enough to, maintain, not like a huge website, but it would be, enough that, the website itself could all be contained on the craft and powered by the same onboard technology that's powering the rest of the vehicle.
Is it going to have any visuals that you could use on it?
It would work the same way as any other website. You can pretty much upload whatever, but the biggest limit for this particular piece of technology would be the internet connection. If it were, out in the middle of the ocean, the satellite connection wouldn't be ideal for something like hosting a website.
Okay. And so photo. I mean, could you mount any kind of video equipment on there and be taking pictures too?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely something that's possible. It's not like a standard feature that they brag about, but it's definitely possible with the onboard electronics.
Okay. Once again, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And David and Lewis Center, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Welcome.
Thank you. I was just curious if there's some way that the designers of these small vessels can come up with a way to avoid shipping lanes or freighters, or do they just put them in places in the ocean that aren't traveled, or how do they deal with that kind of problem?
My understanding of how these work, they are very light and they're very easy to move out of the way. And like I said, the top part is essentially like a surfboard. So I would think that something massive like a cruiser, a carrier passing through a shipping lane or something like that would generate enough force on its own that it would just kind of nudge it out of the way without there being any actual damage.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a great question that I didn't actually see an answer to on their website.
They just kind of bob around and
have any kind of onboard motors or anything like that. When you want to pick them up, you have to go and, you know, physically get them. So it would be interesting to see, you know, I would assume that, you know, maybe not this model, but another model would have, you know, it would be possible to, because they're GPS aware, to give them some kind of guidance to keep them away from shipping lanes. But I don't know that that's currently something that is either a concern or something that they're working on.
Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Welcome, Ed.
Yes, thank you. I was curious as to what's the possibility on upsizing something like this. Thinking when you talked about them being out in the ocean, I thought immediately about that mid-Pacific gyre where all of those plastic bits and pieces and stuff end up spinning around out there. And would something like this be able to be upsized and maybe used to clean up something like that, or maybe oil spills? And I will listen offline.
Thanks, Ed.
So the, you know, anytime you deal with, you know, onboard robotics where things are moving around and doing things, they consume a lot more power. So I would say that something like that is certainly possible, especially if you're talking about scale. But I don't know that, a water version of WALL-E would be sufficient without some additional kind of power source.
Oh, WALL-E. I love that. 614-292-8513. We're going to turn our sights now to of keyboards and mice. You wanted to talk about the launch of new keyboards and mice from the company Logitech.
So yeah. Logitech does a ton of stuff, especially recently. If you have an iPad, their iPad keyboards have been really great. But something that they've drifted away from a little while now, something they were, you know, really a big part of, I guess maybe, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, was the, you know, gaming related hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have talked about that before, where, you know, gaming related hardware can be used in a practical space. They obviously don't look particularly professional.
Mm-hmm.
and so Logitech has done, you know, a kind of a reboot of their gaming line, which they call the G series. For keyboards and mice. And I spent a little bit of time with them last week, and I was really impressed with some of the stuff that they've got going on. And their pricing is pretty reasonable too. Their first keyboard is actually due out in 2 weeks, and it was they're $110. And it was a really great keyboard to type on.
Well, what makes it great? Well, are you talking about keyboards to use with gaming?
No, well, I mean, just keyboards in general.
In general, okay.
That can also do gaming things. And usually what defines a gaming keyboard, aside from, you know, kind of the ridiculously sci-fi look that they often have to them, are programmable buttons that can be used for macros in game, so that you can press a button and a series of commands will go off in the game. But that can be applied to, you know, any kind of computing. If you have repetitive tasks that you do on your computer that you could program into a programmable keyboard. So they definitely have, you know, I hate to say real world, but they definitely have practical applications that are not related to playing video games. But aside from those, they do also make really good keyboards.
All right, we need to say some way to distinguish between whatever world you're in, Russell, and where the rest of us live. It's the real world. Tell me about what makes a special mouse when it comes to gaming.
This actually gets kind of crazy because there are a lot of things that go into separating a gaming mouse from, I guess, a mouse that you would, you know, pick off the shelf at Walmart or something like that. And what really defines them is the measure of accuracy that they have when it comes to, moving even just like pixels apart on a screen, how accurate they are. There are a lot of, kind of really out there gamers who think that makes a big difference. But another thing are mice that have the ability to adjust the actual weight of the mouse by adding or subtracting weight from the device itself.
Where do they put it?
Oh, they're cartridges essentially that weigh different amounts, 30 grams, 50 grams, or something like that, and they slot into the bottom of the mouse to add just that little bit of weight for whatever your personal preference is when using the mouse. And it may be that you prefer different weights for different kinds of games.
Huh. I mean, I was going to say maybe different size hands.
Different size hands can have a big thing, a big bit to do with it. And one of the things that the Logitech did with this particular brand of mice, the edges where, your thumb and your pinky finger typically rest are actually, they're almost sandpaper rough, so that you're not really gripping the mouse so much as just kind of moving it gently with your fingers, which is a common thing. It's important that I say all of this and make clear that I do not own or use a gaming mouse. Even when I'm playing video games, I don't personally feel the need for them, and I'm probably just not that good.
I can't believe
those kind of games.
So how good would you have to be? Because there's some really good
it's
people.
It's a lot, and maybe it's not even, maybe you just think you're that good.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe there's just a thing that goes on there. But, separate, the mice are definitely an interesting look, and they start at about $70 for mice, which in my opinion is a little high for just kind of the average consumer's mouse. But their keyboard line was much more reasonably priced, and the keys they're very well spaced. They felt very nice to type on. If you are still a desktop user, they are definitely worth looking at, but it's also worth warning that they don't look even remotely professional. They definitely have the same kind of sci-fi futuristic look, complete with a backlit keyboard that you can customize to whatever color you want.
So that, when you say don't look professional, it would work just as well, but it may distract other people.
It may distract somebody else.
Sounds kind of cool.
I mean, I think that, my keyboard is green backlit, but I also type a lot in the dark. So it's easier for me to work that way. But it may be, I don't know, it may be disconcerting to walk into your boss's office and see that he's got a bright blue keyboard.
All right. So let's move on to HTC One. The smartphone maker HTC is releasing its flagship phone this week. We talked a little bit about it last week. I can't remember if it was with you or not, but tell us about the HTC One and what it's been born to do.
So the HTC One is, it's an Android phone. And HTC has been doing Android phones since the very first one that came out. So they've got a pretty good handle on how the market has changed and the best ways to kind of compete with the other phone makers that are out there. But this is really a unique phone for, the phones that are out there today. They focused really hard on a really, I don't even know how to appropriately word that. It has a unique feel when you pick it up and hold it. It has an aluminum body that is similar to what you would expect when you pick up, let's say, the iPhone 5. But the back and the sides are actually curved so that it just kind of fits in your hand, even though it's significantly larger than the iPhone.
Okay.
The camera is a unique piece of technology that they're calling an ultra pixel, which is the sensor in it is larger and it works a little differently from normal cameras. And what I found with this particular camera is that it definitely works very differently from what you would expect, your iPhone or maybe a Samsung Galaxy S3 or 4 to do. The sensor takes in a lot more light. And what I found, I was a little confused when they said that. And after testing it, what I found that meant was, if you are in a place where lighting is low, you know, maybe you're at an evening event or something like that, and you go to take a picture, your phone traditionally doesn't get particularly good shots of those things without a flash. And
right.
even with a flash, sometimes it's really not great. I stood outside with a candle on my front porch, and it was completely dark outside. It was two nights ago when the northern lights were supposed to be visible from my house, which they weren't, and that made me sad. But I was messing around with this camera, and my normal phone was able to capture the light from the candle, you know. But the HTC One was able to capture light from all the way down the street, you know, where I could barely see with my eyes. So it was really impressive to see, you know, how dynamic this camera worked in such a variety of situations. It's definitely not like any other phone camera that I've used. And I think that that's kind of an important thing, as we've talked before about, you know, using our phones more as point and shoot cameras than, you know, than we do actually going and buying a separate point and shoot camera.
Yeah, this is the most outstanding camera you've ever described as far as a phone camera goes.
It was definitely a brand new experience for me. And I play with every smartphone that comes out and have for the last couple of years. And this was really a truly unique experience for me. I was really impressed with it.
Why can't all phones be like this? This is an HT. I mean, it's the phone issue's been irritating.
They certainly can. This just really requires a different kind of engineering. So, you know, when we look at cameras right now, the first thing that anybody asks when they see a camera is, you know, how many megapixels is that? What's really weird about this camera working as well as it does is if you measure this camera in megapixels, it's only a 4-megapixel camera.
Wow.
What that means is exactly, you know, so when you hear, you know, okay, it's a 4-megapixel camera, I would immediately turn my nose up at that on a spec sheet. But having held this phone, it's a completely different kind of camera technology. And that's really what helps set it apart.
So what about battery life? Because it's going to suck up more because of this phone, maybe?
No, you know, it's got a pretty standard battery in there, and I've been using it for a couple of days now, and it easily gets me through, you know, a 10-hour day without dying. And I'm pretty aggressive when it comes to you know, using a phone and chewing up battery life. So unless you're playing, you know, video games or anything like that, then it's pretty different. When we did talk about this phone before, I mentioned that it actually has both speakers in the front,
okay,
which is really different. Another thing that's really different from any other phone that's out there right now, the iPhone speaker has traditionally been on the bottom, and most companies put their speakers in the back just because it's a comfortable place to put the speakerphone when you want to play things loud. This has a pair of stereo speakers on the front, and the sound difference when you go to listen to something is incredible. I mean, you hold this thing in your hand and you essentially feel like you're sitting in a surround sound environment listening to a song or a YouTube video or something. So it was really kind of a jarring experience to hear the difference.
Yeah.
Especially when my alarm clock went off this morning. that was not my favorite.
Well, it got you out of bed, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And a dedicated amp, they call it the boom sound.
Yeah, HTC likes to put a lot of silly names on things.
I understand that, at least, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Russell, I've got to say goodbye now. Thank you so much for joining us today, as usual.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com, regular on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support comes from Varmint Guard Environmental Services, the company with the gold-lettered black trucks. Varmint Guard has served Central Ohio for over 30 years, helping to treat and prevent pest and wildlife problems. More information at 614-794-8169 or varmintguard.com.